The Mike Lupica Podcast.
We are back now with the great Mike Lupica. He's one of the country's
most prominent
sports
columnists. Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends. In-your-face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A billion-dollar industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on the Mike Lupica Podcast. Today, we are joined by an old friend, a man with more than 30 years of political analyst experience. So it's safe to say he has seen a lot in the political world. He's done it for ABC, CNN, CBS, NBC, PBS. There are probably other S's that he's done it for. I just don't know. He's authored 13 books, the latest, If Kennedy Lived. He is the great Jeff Greenfield. But before we get started with Jeff, I want to tell you about Cronos. No one compliments you when their paycheck is correct, but make one mistake and you risk alienating your entire workforce. With Cronos, we make sure your payroll is done right the first time, from punch to paycheck. Embedded checklists, simplified workflows, a single source of truth. HR, payroll, talent, and time, keeping in one unified system, all with proven implementation approach and simplified, transparent pricing. Learn more at Cronos.com/payroll. Cronos, workforce innovation that works. We're joined today by an old friend of mine. I first met Jeff Greenfield when he was working on a book about the Boston Celtics and the sport's greatest dynasty, 59 through 67, I think were the years that Jeff dealt with. He comes out of the New York political experience of Robert F. Kennedy. He is an author. He has appeared doing political commentary at just about every network. You see him now on PBS Weekend. He writes for Politico. And he is a Yankee fan of great note. Good morning, Mr. Greenfield.
Good morning. Yeah, I think maybe the next time I think about the Yankees, it'll be a rerun of General Hospital. I mean, this is playing for the Yankees is like being a Spinal Tap drummer this season. You know, they got more guys on the DL than you can shake a stick at. So I'll be interested to see who they field when the season actually starts.
Jeff, you know, it's funny. I got up this morning. I wrote a column for MLB.com about the Yankees and the Red Sox, because even though I think we sometimes assume in the East that there's more interest in this rivalry around the rest of the country than there is, but it always feels like the main event to us. And so I will ask you the question that I pose in this column, because it's kind of intriguing. And the way I set it up is, even the best Yankee fans I know, as they get ready for this season, haven't quite let go of last season. And they're thinking, okay, yeah, they won 108, we won 100, but if they hadn't swept that series in August, and then they look back on the division series and remember how the Red Sox were just hanging on in the bottom of the ninth of game four, and we'll always wonder what happens if Sanchez hits one a little further. Who do you like out of these two teams going into this season?
Are the teams equally healthy or not? If they're
you have to factor that in, and you also factor in the fact that even as many moves as Brian Cashman made after the season started last year, Dombrowski actually did better with the people he picked up for the Red Sox.
You know, what occurred to me even last year was that every year, going back three or four, there's been one new face that suddenly emerges as the savior. It was Bird, then it was Sanchez, then it was Judge. Last year it was supposed to be Stanton. And, you know, the thinking, and this is how fans think, I think, is, gee, if all those guys, A, got healthy,
yep,
and B, did what the potential says they would do, then I think the Yanks would be unstoppable. But you know what? That's on paper. And as people have noted much smarter than I, you do not win world championships on paper. So, you know, I look, as somebody whose memory of Yankees Red Sox goes fairly long back, not quite to when Babe Ruth pitched for Boston, but but my hat's off to them. I think they fielded a spectacular team last year. I think they deserve to win the World Series. I mean, what, the only game they lost was that 45-inning game or whatever it was.
Right.
You know, they did everything they were supposed to do and did it with great efficiency. You know, the players that people might have had doubts about, you know, I think Price came into his own. Chris Sale was great. Martinez was great. It's a really good team. But I do think, you know, if the Yankees could field a healthy team, and if the three or four players, I mean, Judge has been consistent in that sense, that if they played up to what we saw at different parts of the last few years, I think the Yankees could take them.
I'll read you a quote that I use in my column. I don't think the column's posted yet on MLB.com. This is Monday morning. This is from an American League manager who's just a smart guy, and I just threw this question out to him. How good are the Yankees? And this is the answer he gave me. I think they are good if their rotation holds up or if they don't have to absorb so many innings in the pen early. I like their team, but their starting pitchers are low impact. I actually think that's a pretty sound analysis because with the Yankee bullpen, Jeff, it looks like they would love to play five-inning games this year.
Yeah, I think that is right. And which brings us to a second thing, which is, you know how much, for me, baseball is the center of my sports universe because of my age and what New York was like back then. You know, I still remember the days when there was baseball and waiting for baseball, even though that's clearly not where the country is. But I got to tell you, when you mention five-inning games and 12 pitchers per game and all of that,
yeah,
I have to concede to you that if they can't figure out a way to not just pick up the pace, but have a little more action in these games other than true outcomes, it was tough sometimes watching it last year. And much as a fan I am, you know, the strikeout, the walk, the home run, and an increased record number of foul balls, that's not, for me, what makes baseball so intriguing.
Talking to Jeff Greenfield on the Mike Lubega podcast, we're going to get to the, you know, the fact that the world is slowly coming to an end in a minute, but we're talking about something we actually like to talk about and offers us hope and consolation, and that is what my friend Bob Ryan, Jeff's friend too, calls the greatest game ever invented by mortal mind, which is baseball. Jeff, when you look at Aaron Judge, when is the last time, other than perhaps when the core four kids were young, that you have been this excited about a Yankee? And you can't evaluate last season without remembering he missed 50 regular season games after, you know, because he got hit on the wrist.
Right. I mean, I think of all of them, for all kinds of reasons, he's the natural, you know, without Roy Hobbs's liabilities.
Right.
He's everything about him. And what about just as a footnote, because of this lunatic or irrational compensation system, what is Aaron Judge being paid this year?
I think it's still around $600,000 or $700,000. You may have caught me, and I think he's still working on one of those contracts.
Yeah, I'm not trying to trap you. I think that's about right. And so, it's really quite a story. He's completely engaging. He looks like he was built in a baseball factory. And you're right, you know, I mean, put him back in for those 50 games, maybe they come a lot closer to the Red Sox. I think he, of all of them, is the key to the next.
684, you know. My crack producer, Tyler Brewer, has come up with this. $684,000, this is important too, Jeff, $300. $684,300. I bet you think that's a bargain.
Yeah, I think it's the equivalent of being able to buy an Aston Martin for $8,000, if that's a sensible analogy. And it also highlights the fact, and not in the Joe Biden sense, I literally do not understand a system where you will then write a contract that extends till a player is 39 or 40 years old, paying him like $25 or $30 million a year. You know, the whole thing seems backward to me. That you're paying Judge, what is he now, 26, 27?
Yeah.
That much, or that little, and you're going to be paying, who's the best example of this? Pujols, maybe now Harper.
Oh, Miguel Cabrera gets paid. Okay. He's going to have one of those old man contracts because he signed his contract in the 30s. Pujols and Cabrera are and even Robinson Cano, who's now with the Mets, you know, that those contracts, that's why I think it's just complete insanity what the Phillies did with Bryce Harper, despite the fact that I still think, Mr. Greenfield, that he, if they had never made the Stanton deal, Bryce Harper would be a Yankee now.
Could well be. Of course, given the way fate works, I'm sort of taking bets on what day in early April Bryce Harper goes down with an ACL.
Oh, my God. That's, that's just terrible.
Just because the gods like to play with us that way.
We're talking to Jeff Greenfield on the Mike Lupica podcast, and Mr. Greenfield and I would be it would be good for our souls to spend this entire podcast talking about baseball or even basketball. But Jeff, I always like when I have a guest to look at, you know, their last several tweets, and you said you had one yesterday that was resonating to me, and it was about Lindsey Graham not sticking up for a guy who he, you know, always called his best friend John McCain after McCain was attacked. The late John McCain was attacked by Trump in this insane tweet storm of the weekend. I think 30 original tweets and 20 retweets in the space of 48 hours.
What made what Lindsey Graham did for me so reprehensible? They were best friends. McCain was kind of Lindsey Graham's mentor. So gratuitously yesterday or the day before, the president tweets out a series of insults about McCain, last in his class. Of course, we know that because we know what McCain's grades were, but the president's lawyer spent a lot of time threatening schools not to reveal his. Last in his class, a stain on his record. And here's Lindsey Graham. And what he does is he sends out a tweet that says, in effect, John McCain was a patriot and a great man. But he never even says, even the sentence like, and I regret that the president saw fit to insult his memory. He couldn't even bring himself to do that. So it is a tweet unconnected to the reason why he sent the tweet. And it struck me it would have been better if he just kept his mouth, if that's the right phrase, if he just stayed silent, because it's so embarrassing. Well, I love John McCain. And why are you sending this tweet today? Well, because I just want everybody to know what a great guy McCain is. Yeah, but it had something to do maybe with the president repeatedly insulting his memory. John McCain was a great man. It's pathetic.
The tweet from my friend Jeff Greenfield, which was yesterday, says silence would have been much better than this pathetic offering, meaning from Lindsey Graham. If you aren't willing to call Trump out when he insults your best friend in the Senate, then it's hard to see how you could see this as anything but shameful. But Jeff, when I saw Graham's tweet and then he had a second tweet, I thought of some. Paul Westfall, the great old player, is one of my best friends. And when he was coaching the Suns, he called in one of his players and he said, if you don't start playing harder, I'm going to have to go to the media and talk about your stomach problem. And the player said, Coach, I don't have a stomach problem. And Westfall looked at him. He said, yeah, you do. No guts. And that is what I thought of yesterday. That was the stomach problem that we saw from Senator Lindsey Graham, whose behavior has been so shameful over the Trump presidency that you see how far these men will go, these quislings, to hold on to power.
Well, it's a really he's perhaps the most dramatic example, because this involved someone that he so admired and in fact even loved. But you also had in this last run up, and it's basically, it tells you one of President Trump's great successes is that he has so intimidated the members of his party who serve in the House and particularly the Senate, which is supposed to be in general an institutional check on the executive branch, that when he declared this national emergency, you had Senator Tillis do an op-ed in the Washington Post saying, this is not right, I'm going to vote against it. Then somebody back home says, I might primary you, Senator Tillis, because you're not standing up for the president. And when it comes time for the vote, Tillis votes with the president. Ben Sasse, who's got quite a reputation as this outspoken Nebraskan who doesn't like abuses of power, basically did the same thing. And I think Graham was almost at one point candid when he said in some interview, well, you know, in politics, the important thing is you can't do anything if you're not reelected. And there have been threats back home in South Carolina that the next time Lindsey Graham was up, which is next year, there'll be a primary. But as I said, it you know, if you're no admirer of Trump, it may not seem like an achievement, but it is. He has got his party sufficiently cowed because he is so popular with the rank and file that he will do things that in the past no senator of either party would have tolerated, like this declaration of national emergency. We're not invading. The Constitution says you got to get the money from us. We're not giving you the money. Okay, I'll declare a state of national emergency. And except for, I guess, 12 Republicans at this point did vote against him, knowing, by the way, that, you know, a veto would be sustained, would not be overridden. So there you are. It's a quite a remarkable achievement, if that's the right word.
We're talking with Jeff Greenfield on the Mike Lubega podcast. More with Mr. Greenfield in a moment, but first this from Geico. There's a quick way you could save money. Just switch to Geico. All it takes is 15 minutes to find out if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. And Geico offers coverage for more than just car insurance. Got a motorcycle? Geico's got you covered. Got an RV? Covered. Got a boat? Covered. How about a homeowner's or renter's insurance? You bet Geico's got you covered. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save. That's geico.com. Talking to Jeff Greenfield on the Mike Lubega podcast. It will be interesting over the next month, even over the next month or so, Jeff, to see which Democrats Trump views as the biggest threats. He's already got Beto in his sights. And it just, it struck me again the other day that where we are in this country at this time, which I do believe is the year of living dangerously as much as any. And I, you know, I grew up in the 60s and you came of age in the 60s. This is the most dangerous time I have encountered as an American. And when you see the president of the United States just calling basically the other, the former vice president who may run against him stupid before the guy's even in the race, it tells you that before this thing really even gets rolling, Jeff, that Trump will say or do anything to hold on to power.
It's interesting you say that because the other night I was at a dinner. I can't say who. Somebody about as high up as you can get in the institutional, judicial, legal framework.
Okay.
Who expressed genuine concern that Trump might, it's not so much what he says at this point, that, for instance, if the Congress or a grand jury issues subpoenas for records, that unlike Nixon, you know, when the court said turn over the tapes, he knew as soon as he turned over the tapes that he'll just say no. Even express some wonderment about if Trump loses an election next time, he'll say, you know what, it was rigged. And so I really won. The tweets and the threats and the languages, they're all one part of the package. But even the concept, you know, it used to be that only paranoids or real extremists would say things like, well, Nixon's going to cancel the 72 election. Obama's going to cancel the 2012 election. They will never leave. There is more concern from actually respectable elements of just how far this president might go to retain power. That's not a prediction, that this may be overwrought, but the fact that people whose judgment you would think is more kind of calm would even be expressing doubts about this. That's where my concern is. Now, I think it's also worth noting that after yesterday, what did he send out, 28 tweets?
I think the number for the weekend was 30 from himself and 20 retweets beginning Saturday morning and ending on Sunday night.
Yeah, well, so one of the things that, I don't mean to chuckle, except you laugh so you do not weep, you know, George Conway, Kellyanne Conway's husband,
yep,
basically has been tweeting out copies of the the diagnostic manual for mental disorders.
Yep.
Here's the definition of narcissistic personality disorder. Now, that must be really interesting dinner conversation at the Conway home, don't you think?
Oh, I want to spend Thanksgiving with them this year, Jeff. I do. I love being with my family, but I might have to say to them, I'm going to George and Kellyanne's house this year.
Hi, honey. How was your day at the office? It just makes the imagination kind of fire.
Who's the first? Which one of them is going to end up living at Trump International, Kellyanne or George?
You know, or unless the whole thing is a scam and they'll do a book together. When this is all over, you know,
James Carville, right?
That's what I mean. Except Carville and Madeline always had a kind of a wink and a nudge about this. You know, I mean, they were on opposite sides, but they handled it with great humor. It doesn't look to me like George Conway finds the situation all that amusing.
We're talking to Jeff Greenfield on the Mike Lubega podcast, and again, people can go back and look at my newspaper column. I've always said, and my friendship with Jeff aside, there's no sharper take on the current political scene, whatever the political scene is, than Jeff's. You know, Jeff, when you look at what's going on now, okay, and you saw some of those tweets last week where he says, "I've got the military, I've got bikers for Trump." The implication was quite clear that if you move this discussion down the road, that he actually thinks that if he ever loses the next election, there should be rioting and civil war in the streets.
Well, it's hard to read what he says and not draw that conclusion. Now, you know, it's funny. Last night at the 92nd Street Y, a fine institution in New York, I had this public conversation with Alex Burns and Maggie Haberman of the New York Times. And Maggie is kind of like the Trump whisperer. You know, he keeps saying he has nothing to do with her, but he can't quit her. He's constantly talking to her.
Right.
And one of the people in the audience asked, when Trump tweets or says these things, do you think he means it, or is it just kind of for political purposes? And she said, you know, I can't answer that question because I just don't know. I've been trying to figure that out. I just don't know what the answer is. So it's hard to know whether to take that. You know, who was it who said in the White House, one of his supporters said, you should take Trump seriously, but not literally. And it's just hard to know whether sometimes, by the way, I think because he has a kind of feral intelligence of sorts. Sometimes I think when he tweets things like that out, he does it deliberately to troll, to provoke the people who don't like him. But it's hard to know. I mean, he certainly has had enough. He's said often enough to his supporters, you know, why don't you beat up the protesters? I'll take bail. When he said to the police, you know, you don't have to be careful when you put them into that cruiser, bang their head. There's a kind of appetite for physical violence offered by a man who, you know, I don't know that Trump has ever been in a fist fight, even back in third grade. You know, so there's a fascination with this. And whatever it is, it's just not something that I'm particularly relieved about to find in the Oval Office.
You just used the word feral intelligence, okay? And I think I've used the word cunning about him. It continues to fascinate me, and your political sweep is far more extensive than my own, and you're far more of an insider than I will ever be, that this man, who is not interested in anything other than his own ambition and his own power, who knows nothing about government, who you could stump by asking actually the mechanics of turning a bill into law, has exploited every single goddamn weakness in our system of governance to his own advantage to this point.
I agree with that. I do think it's important to say that part of what is responsible for this, and this is not just true in the United States, but the grievance factor is that for a significant number of people at the lower end of the economic order, the people in power let them down over years. So I'm talking about, you know, the enormous incredible inequality in American economic life. The showering of benefits to the top 1%, that didn't start with Trump. That happened under Clinton, and it happened under Bush, and it happened under Obama. And promises were made to these people. You know, yeah, the economy's changing. You know, maybe the lifetime in a factory isn't going to get you what it did, but we're going to fix that somehow, and never did. And while I think it's true that racial and cultural grievance is at the heart of Trump's appeal, the tinder, the fuel that made that so powerful, is rooted in the sense that these folks have been, in one writer's word, unprotected. And by the way, it may not seem like it, but this last story about manipulating college admissions.
Yeah.
If you wanted a piece of wanted a story that absolutely convinced those who are not yet convinced that the system is utterly rigged. I mean, I picture some kid from a single parent home, struggling through community college and two jobs to try to get to a better school, and then looks up and sees that rich parents, not content with all the other benefits, spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes to get their kid into college. I mean, how does, you know, what does that tell you about a system? What does it tell you about why people may feel with some legitimacy that this is a rigged system? And, you know, people who feel that way, it's one of the reasons why Bernie Sanders, you know, did as well as he did in 16, and it's one of the reasons Donald Trump did as well as he did. And you can say and be accurate, but Trump hasn't done anything for these people. Now he wants to cut Medicare. Trump, but at the point of grievance, it may not even matter that you believe he's going to do it. They want to hear somebody say what they believe. And, you know, that's part of what we've been living through. Brexit, it's the yellow vests in France. It's the growth of populist parties in, you know, all over Europe. It's the Philippines. It makes me wonder.
Jeff, what was your reaction yesterday? I mean, it's like a lawyer asking a question in court that you sort of already know the answer to. But I meant to ask you this high up in our conversation today. What was your reaction yesterday when you saw the GOP official Twitter site put a picture of Beto O'Rourke on this St. Paddy's Day, a special message from noted Irishman Robert Francis O'Rourke? Please drink responsibly.
I think of the late Senator Pat Moynihan, who described our culture as defining deviancy down. But here's a charitable explanation: rank stupidity. That is to say, they're trying to make a point that when he was young, Beto O'Rourke was arrested for a DUI. And it never occurred to them that one of the ugly stereotypes is, well, you know, the Irish, they all drink. And so if you wanted to, as I said, the excuse is rank stupidity. But there are times when you see something like that and you shake your head and you go, I think of the late unlamented Congressman James Traficant, who before he went to jail for corruption, used to end every speech on the House floor by saying, "Beam me up, Scotty." And there are times when I look at this whole political world that I thought I understood after, you know, a fair number of years. And I feel like a pilot who's been flying airplanes for 30 years. And one day, just as I take off, the tower says, tower to cockpit, you should just know that the law of gravity has been suspended. That's how sometimes I feel so alienated and distant from this political process.
You know, I wonder if the same people who sent that tweet out yesterday think that you should also be able to stereotype people of German descent as all of them wanting to walk around and say that they ought to be able to grab women by the pussy. Do you think that wouldn't that be a logical extension of that argument, Jeff?
I would not bring logic into anything that we're talking about at this point. The logic, that's my point. I would have thought, you know, 3 or 4 years ago that some of what this president has said would have rendered him completely unable to compete in an election. I would have thought when that comment came out, and there was, in fact, an effort to on the part of some Republicans to drop him from the ticket in the middle of the election. The fact that they didn't, much less that he won an electoral, electoral college victory, you have to really then go back and say, what is it that I did not grasp about what's going on here? In fact, I'll give you what's the line? I think it's from Diner, where these working class guys are out in Maryland and they see this beautiful woman riding a horse in the middle of this gorgeous estate. And one of them says, you ever get the feeling there's something going on that we just don't know anything about? And that's sometimes my feeling when I watch the current political scene.
Talking to Jeff Greenfield on the Mike Lubega podcast, you know, I want to, when you were talking about this strongman theory of like invalidating an upcoming election or the strongman wanting to stay on, please remember that when Giuliani, not this iteration of Giuliani, but when he was still the hero mayor of New York City after September 11th, remember, Jeff, he wanted to stay on. And even at the height of his popularity at that point, people said, no, we're still going to have an election.
Right. And it took Mike Bloomberg in what I consider the one of the least admirable moments of an otherwise very admirable career. He actually managed to get term limits suspended so that he could stay on another term. He did it in a more subtle way. Yeah, Giuliani did that. And look, that's what I meant when I said when Nixon was told by the Supreme Court, 8-0, including justices he had put on the court, you have to turn over the tapes. He didn't burn them. He didn't call out the guard, the 82nd Airborne. He gave him the tapes, knowing it would end his career. Go back a few decades. It's not very well remembered, but during the Korean War, during a steel strike, Harry Truman, President Truman, wanted to seize the steel mills temporarily so that they could produce armaments. And the Supreme Court said, no, you don't have that power. And basically Truman said, oh, okay, I won't do it. But this guy, there's always this question of whether or not he has any understanding institutionally of where power lies and what power he doesn't have, so that if the courts were to say, you have to turn over these documents, he would say, oh, okay, I guess I do, or say, it's rigged, it's unfair, it's a deep state, it's fake news, I'm not doing it. I don't know that's what's going to happen if it comes to that. I hope I'm wrong. I hope these fears are completely unjustified. But the fact that they're around and hailed by people who, under normal circumstances, you just wouldn't think would ever say this stuff is a little chilling.
And Jeff, you know, you look at what's happening in the country right now, and it makes me think back, and this it falls in line with what you're talking about. Okay, Jimmy Breslin, our friend Jimmy Breslin, once wrote a wonderful book about impeachment, called "How the Good Guys Finally Won," and it's really, you know, it's a small book, and everybody's writing these big lofty books at that time, and Breslin tells the story through the eyes of Tip O'Neill, and there's a scene at the end, and I'm going to paraphrase this, where Nixon has resigned, and O'Neill is in Washington, and he looks out his window, and he talks about what's just happened in this country, and he makes the observation, without a tank in the street, that somehow this incredible historical moment had happened without any violence, that the power had been transferred in the greatest country in the world, and that was Tip's line, without a tank in the street.
Yeah, but you know what here's, I have heard from the very get-go a pushback when people talk about Watergate, because I think it can mislead us. Watergate happened at a time when in both houses of Congress, the Democrats had big majorities. Second, the Republican Party was radically different from what it is now. You had all manner of moderate and even liberal Republicans. You had Jacob Javits in New York, Clifford Case of New Jersey. You had Chuck Percy in Illinois. You had Tom Kuchel in California. And you had all of these, you know, during the House Judiciary Committee, you had a bunch of Republicans, Larry Hogan, now the governor of Maryland, who who were not in lockstep. And by the way, you also had no Fox News, no Breitbart. So there was,
which you can't ignore, Jeff. I was having this conversation with family members last night. Nixon would have made it. He would have gotten through if there had been Fox News in the 1970s. 100%.
He certainly would have gotten through if he'd had a majority of Republicans in the Senate and a Republican Party like this one. You know, it's a wholly different Republican Party. So all I mean is, you know, I know that CNN, by the way, if they have one more panel, you know, 5 hours a night of these panels, I've had enough. Thank God the baseball season has started because, you know, well, we don't know what's in the Mueller report, but let's talk about it for 2 hours with our team of 12 panelists. But yeah, I think the difference in the politics of now and 1973 and 4 is a big explanation, not the least of which is, given the way, if Nixon had been able to persuade the entire Republican Party to dismiss anything Archibald Cox had said, he wouldn't have had to fire him. He'd have just said, fake news, not true, forget it, you can't believe it. And his people go, that's right, fake news.
All right, I'm going to give you three names. You pick out. You can take them in any order you want. The killer bees: Beto, Biden, Bernie.
Well, they're all running for president.
I you know, I keep up. Yes, I know.
Here's what I said. There's a phrase I have to use from my culture. I tweeted it and I said it last night at this thing. One of the things about Bernie Sanders is he is the first openly Farbissinian candidate for president.
I saw that, and I have to admit, I think I do keep up, and okay, and I had no idea what the hell you were talking about.
Sourpuss. That's a Farbissinian. A constant, yeah, a complainer, a kvetcher, you know. The way Larry David played Bernie Sanders last year on SNL, you know, people go up to him, they love him, and he goes, go away, leave me. Larry David played Bernie Sanders as if Bernie Sanders were Larry David. It's unfair to him. He just has a particular manner. The one thing I think, and it's less what I think than what my New York Times friend said last night, both of them, I think it's really easy to underestimate Bernie Sanders' potential. He came remarkably close 4 years ago. He is a money-raising machine in small donations, and his, you know, he has legitimate reason to say, all you people talking about Medicare for all and college and all that, I was there ahead of you. So he has a base. Beto just revealed his money raising. He outraised Bernie. So it's a kind of real contrast between the older kind of policy leftist Bernie and this new kid on the block who's, nobody's really quite sure what he stands for, but he seems to have this enormous, you know, to use the cliche, rock star appeal. And Biden's a great unknown. I mean, if your interest was just in beating Trump and there was a bunch of guys smoking cigars in a room to pick a candidate for the Democratic Party, they'd probably pick Biden. But in this Democratic Party, which is substantially more left than it was when Biden was running with Obama even, they've got a lot of questions about his past. And we've also know, quite candidly, that Biden always looks better before he enters a race. But if you're looking for prognostication, the only thing I'm interested in is when they put 20 Democratic candidates on a debate stage or 10 in running as entries, they're going to have to confine their answers to a haiku. That's all they're going to have time for. 17 syllables. You know, if Roosevelt was around today, he'd say the only thing we have to fear is time's up. So it's going to be quite a circus.
Can right. someone run from the far left and beat Donald Trump?
I think that's a real problem. And the reason I think that is that for all the attention given to the new left folks like, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who, by the way, is wonderful at hearing. She's the only person I've seen who knows how to ask questions. That when you look at who actually won in the midterms for the Democrats throughout the country, they were much more moderate, centrist liberals than they were, you know, self-identified socialists. And, you know, it's sometimes a hard thing to remember in politics, but you don't win by only getting your biggest, most impassioned supporters. And particularly with an electoral college, you've got to look at the states. It's not going to help the Democrat if they win by 3 million votes or 5 million votes if they're all in California and New York and they lose. They've got a, I think it's a real problem for them not to become identified with something further to the left than where the country is. You can run as a progressive, and you can run as a progressive in purple and even red states. Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio, has demonstrated that. But you've got to be able to have a connection to where you're willing to say the way Amy Klobuchar did, the senator from Minnesota, I'd love to do Medicare for all. I just don't think we can afford it.
Do you think Beto O'Rourke can win the Democratic nomination?
I'm passing because I haven't a clue. I literally think that the mechanisms, here's what I would say. It's less crazy than it would have been 4 years ago or 8 years ago. And the reason is Donald Trump. You know, he demonstrated that none of the things we think are relevant or critical to a presidential candidate, experience, judgment, civility, grace, a knowledge of civics, none of it matters if you connect at this kind of primal level with what people want. And on the opposite side, you know, whether it's reconciliation, a kind of a calmer, more dispassionate, more reasonable approach to the presidency, if that's what a war can demonstrate, the fact that he's kind of thin on the record side or, you know, a little vague on the policy side, that's not going to be a disqualification. And there may be other things. So I just think we're in a, you know, we're in a political climate that looks so radically different from it was just a few years ago that I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't place bets on anybody. Look, and I mean, this guy, this mayor of South Bend, Pete Buttigieg, you know, that was a very impressive town meeting. Now, this is a 37-year-old mayor of South Bend, Indiana.
And he was impressive with Chris Wallace, too, Jeff.
Yeah, very. Who was not just gay, but, you know, married to a guy. Now, is that a bridge too far in 2020? You know, the conventional analysis would be, well, yeah, but who the hell knows? Let it play out. I sometimes think, my last point to you, that us political types are like the kids in the backseat of a car as it pulls out of the driveway on the way to a vacation. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? We don't know. This, you know, the phony baloney Iowa caucuses don't take place for almost 10 months. So I'm prepared to just wait and see and start concentrating on whether or not Stanton and Judge and Sanchez and Byrd and Gregorius, if he comes back, you know, do what I hope they can do.
Jeff Greenfield, watch him, please, on PBS on weekends. Read him in Politico. Again, there is no sharper or more practical take on the current political scene than his. Hey, pal, thank you for doing this.
Always a pleasure, Mike. See you at the stadium, maybe.
Jeff Greenfield on the Mike Lubega podcast. Again, I knew it at the end of this, I'd want to do another 40 minutes with him, but please enjoy. Please continue to download. Please continue to subscribe. There's a reason why we're doing this twice a week now instead of once. And we'll talk to you in a few days, everybody.
The Mike Lupica podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.